Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Rick Brown, my friend Rick Brown, Dr. Rick Brown. He's the founder and chairman of Terra Verde Energy, an extraordinarily accomplished consulting firm. He founded it in 2009. They've done over $500 million worth of distributed resources projects in California and elsewhere. Now, Rick is highly involved in the state's solar policy. We'll be talking about that today. It's just great having Rick on the podcast with us. Hey, Rick, good to see you. Thanks for joining the podcast today.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
And where are you sitting as we speak?
I'm sitting in my home in Petaluma, California, just north of the San Francisco Bay Area.
And that's been your home base for decades, I presume.
Well, Sonoma County, we've been in Sonoma County for almost 35 years. Petaluma for the last 15. Yeah.
Okay, very good. And I know you've stepped back from your work at Terra Verde in somewhat, but what are you working on today? I know you're still advocating. What are you working on today?
Well, a lot of my time is spent on advocacy work through a number of different venues. I'm on the executive committee of the School Energy Coalition, which is a sister organization of CASH, the statewide organization of facility directors for schools. I'm also just recently joined the board of the California Solar and Storage Association. And then we have a strong relationship already with a number of other organizations, in particular AQUA, the Association of California Water Agencies. Partner with on a number of advocacy issues. And then I'm always out there besides the policy stuff, and being a board member for Terra Verde, president of the board for Terra Verde, I'm always sort of sticking my fingers into different things and seeing where some of the new opportunities might be and passing them on to our team.
Yeah. And your team must really value your perspectives. They must be happy to have you around.
I hope so. I think so.
Well, some presidents or CEOs, it's time for them to move on. But
you've
got such a wealth of knowledge. You founded Terra Verde, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 2009.
That's correct. Yep.
I did a little bit of homework. You have shepherded or fostered over $500 million worth of distributed energy resource project?
Actually, it's closer to 650 now. Our website's a little out of date, but yeah, we at Terra Verde. Yeah, that's right.
So and when you step in, go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Primarily solar and or battery storage at schools and other public agencies, water agencies, transit agencies, cities, counties, et cetera. But we also, as you know, we're very involved with the Prop 39 program. So that involved probably 60, 70 million of mechanical equipment, lighting, and so forth that we helped school districts figure out how to best implement.
Yep. That's really something. How many school districts were you working with back in the Prop 39 days?
Gosh, in the Prop 39 days, probably about, 40 or 50. I think that's about as much as we could handle at the time. Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a lot, Rick. So the Terra Verde model, you started in 2009. I'm presuming you saw sort of like what I saw, a real need for an owner's rep to get into these solar deals. Talk about that void or talk about that need that you saw.
Yeah. I was on a school board for 6 years in the 90s when my kids were going to school and kind of got an inside view of some of the challenges that school districts have in managing the operation side of their business. And part of the problem is that just historically been way underfunded. Always, the first priority is teachers in the classroom, which, it should be.
It should be.
And so that was the impetus for me saying, schools need a partner who can evaluate this new thing, solar energy, to figure out when and where and how does it make sense to go solar. And then eventually, obviously, battery storage came along. And also other public agencies had a similar need. But back when we founded it was schools that we were mostly focused on to help them figure out, A, from an economic standpoint, financially, is this a winner for them? Because schools didn't have the luxury of basically having negative cash flow around their energy costs. And so if a solar project didn't pencil pretty much from day one, they really weren't in a position to go forward. But if it did make sense based on our analysis, then we would sit, you know, at the table with them to figure out what's the best way of procuring. And that's the owner's rep role. And that involved either, you know, most cases putting together an RFP process, working with the various bidders to figure out what is the best proposal, not just from a economic standpoint, but also from a, you know, long-term contract relationship standpoint, because unfortunately, you know, this is the reality with a new technology. Some companies are better positioned to provide that long-term support than others. And so we were able to advise people on here's where the risks are, here's where the opportunities were, and then provide that project management, construction management support during the implementation phase and then the commissioning phase. And actually we also, and this is the part that I'm in right now, you know, most jazzed about, we established a asset management service that provides the long-term operations and maintenance oversight, as well as sort of classic asset management support for our clients.
You know, I want to get into the asset management, but let me back you up just for a second, because around that time, 2009, I think EcoMotion was formed in 2007, but we were of a mind that there were quite a few of these school districts and perhaps government agencies were upside down with their solar deals, right?
Exactly.
They had gotten into these solar deals. Maybe the initial PPA price looked okay, but they really weren't tracking what the escalators were and how that, you know, how that was going to jive with the utility rates. Did you find that in your work too?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that was, you know, that was one of the reasons why I got into the business, is I saw that from my previous experience. And unfortunately, Ted, it's still going on. We still find examples of, you know, schools getting into deals that they didn't understand, honestly. Yep. They didn't understand. And we have a little business where we go in and help them figure out how to either renegotiate or somehow figure out a way to optimize the value, even if the underlying contract has problems.
Well, that's fantastic. And now, you know, we, back in 2009, it was basically a solar game, right? There wasn't, now you had the complexity. Now you had the complexity of all the batteries. And so we're always modeling the batteries, and now we're adding all this resilience into the equation as well.
Exactly.
So I think,
you know, now
integration, right, with EVs.
Yeah. It's gotten more complex. And as you know, the policy, going back to the advocacy piece, while we think of this as an engineering and financial modeling and development process, as you know, the policy, you know, landscape is very much a driver of what works and doesn't work. And so what may have worked 2 years ago may not work today. And maybe things coming down the pike in a couple of years will make other things work that don't work today. So you do have to stay on top of that solar coaster policy world to help your clients make sure they're getting the best value out of whatever they go into.
Well, I really like that term, the solar coaster. I hadn't heard that.
I think we probably had to reinvent the model in the 15 years now, at least six times, based on policy issues. And obviously we did.
CSI goes away.
The very first solar plus storage project at a school district in 2014. And it's, you know, it's evolved obviously very, very much since then.
Yeah. So you the Terra Verde model, you do all the feasibility for district or agency or whatnot. If that looks good, you help them procure, get the right vendor on board. And the right vendor is really important. It's not necessarily the least cost, of course.
That's right.
And then there's all sorts of stuff comes up during construction and interconnection and commissioning. But let's get back to this asset management, because I think I was so impressed by that when I first learned that you were doing this. And so as my colleague Michael Ware said to me this morning, he said, well, so they are the O&M provider. Is that right?
Well, we don't roll trucks. What we do is we manage the people who roll. So it depends on whether it's a client ownership system or a PPA, right? Under client owned model, we do the soup to nuts, but we do it as an owner's rep. So we periodically run RFPs for maintenance services, right? And that usually is every 1 or 2 years to get the best value from the market in terms of doing the inspections, doing the warranty enforcement, doing the corrective maintenance and preventive maintenance that you need to do on a regular basis to get that, you know, top value. We also do reporting. So besides the performance of the system that we're looking at through that O&M lens, we also do a financial reporting. We have a proprietary software called Solar Shadow that allows us to figure out what would their bill have been if they hadn't gone solar. So we can actually show them, based on what benefit they're getting, how much they're saving to the penny on their solar project, net of financing costs, you know, corrective maintenance, et cetera. And then we also do, we provide them, and this is the one area that I hope people listen to, which is there's a very valuable REC market out there, renewable energy credit market. And we find a lot of situations where the school or the public agency isn't aware that they could be collecting money, cash flow, selling their RECs. And so we provide that service. We interface with the market there. We make sure they're all the REC, all the kinds of paperwork and registrations that need to happen. And then we're continually working in the REC market to get them the best value for the RECs. And we're talking, for a typical school district, anywhere from $15,000 to $50,000 a year that they're leaving on the table because they just didn't know that was available to them, both under an ownership model and even in some situations where there's a PPA. Sometimes a PPA provider owns the RECs under the contract, but a lot of times they don't.
Yeah.
And nobody's doing the work.
Yeah, it's that little paragraph on who has the environmental attributes that in the PPA. But Rick, go back a little bit here. What has shocked me, and I'm wondering if it's shocked you, I'm presuming it is how focused everybody is on at the beginning when they're building a project. They're looking at the cost effectiveness and the board needs, you know, meet certain, you know, investment criteria, all that good stuff. And then the project gets built. Yeah. And it's just amazing how little attention there is. Right? Right. And very, you know, well to.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and part of that, Ted, unfortunately, is I hate to say it, but the solar industry kind of puts out this message that one of the great things about solar is you build it and then you don't have to worry about it. And, you know, that is, you know, you don't have to worry about as much as other kinds of electrical equipment, but you do have to do at least a basic level of monitoring and, like I said, preventive maintenance, warranty enforcement, corrective maintenance to make sure you're getting that full value of the system. I can't tell you the number of times we get contacted by an agency that says, you know, we put solar in 4 or 5 years ago. I know we're saving somebody some money, but I'm not sure how much and I'm not sure how it's working. Can you take a look? And we'll go in and we'll look and it's operating at 50% of what it's, you know, been set up to do because nobody took the time to look at the, you know, the inverter, to clean the filter, to, you know, tighten some screws. I mean, you know, I'm not an engineer or anything, but there's some basic stuff that you just have to stay on top of. And part of the issue is if you don't do that preventive maintenance, then when something bad happens, right, if something crashes, you are at risk of not being able to use your warranty to make a claim. And so it's one of those things where, and again, it goes back to particularly for schools, and it is with other, we've seen this with other agencies, I shouldn't just focus on schools, who have so many things they're dealing with. They have so many maintenance needs that it's hard for them to stay on top of this, particularly because there is a unique expertise associated with it. And so, you know, most maintenance folks at schools have not been trained in solar panels and inverters and et cetera. And so that's where we come in to provide that backup. And sometimes we have some clients where we'll do it for 3 or 4 or 5 years and we end up training their maintenance staff. They're a big enough district and then we peel off and we don't have to do as many of the services because we've trained them to be able to do some of the front end kinds of stuff. Yep. Most cases, they still want us to do the monitoring. They still want us to help them in getting the best value from the O&M market the rec stuff, but a lot of the basic maintenance and you know, both corrective and preventive, there's some districts that have a big enough maintenance staff that we can transfer that knowledge so that they can take that over.
Yeah. And one thing that strikes me is when you talk about those reports that you do, that shows, you know, what the system is saving or what it could save, but what it is saving.
It's actually saving. It's not a projection. It's an actual. Yeah.
Well, but then don't you, but if the system was operating at 100%, I'm sure you're presenting that number
right.
too.
And that's what we use as one of the metrics. And generally systems, you know, you're seldom going to get 100%. Sometimes you get 102% because the system has been overbuilt, which is a whole other issue. Sometimes, you know, because of, you know, weather issues, you may only get 94%, 96%. Yeah. But most contracts have a performance guarantee. At least the contracts we negotiate on behalf of our clients have a performance guarantee that says if it's any less than a certain percentage, and usually that's 95%, then the vendor, be it the PPA provider or the EPC who built it, has to pay for that. Yep. And that's another area where people don't realize, you know, I mean, we get called in, oh, my system, you know, I've had it for 7 or 8 years. And we go and look, do you know that you have a performance guarantee? No. Now, part of that's because the person who's the maintenance guy today wasn't there 7 years ago, right?
Yeah, lots of turnover.
Do you know that your system's operating at 88% and they owe you $75,000? No. And then we have to go through a process of documenting, you know, going back and doing the forensics to document how the system is underperformed, present that to the PPA provider or you know, EPC, and then we help them collect. But unfortunately, it goes back to your first point that people, you know, they put it in and then they forget about it.
Yeah. And I was going to make the point that your reports where you're talking about the value of the system, I found that that's really important because often we have repair costs that we have to incur. And the facilities maintenance guys don't know how does this $50,000, $100,000, how does this compare with, you know, the actual generation and what I can expect in the future? They just don't know.
Yeah, and we put into our models, when we tell them this is what we think how it's going to perform, we show that there are going to be, we have a maintenance budget. We say there, you know, here's what you should be setting aside every year for maintenance. And then there's equipment replacement. You know, we're now long enough into the period of solar going into schools and public agencies that we're getting to the period where the economic useful life of central inverters or string inverters is coming to an end. I mean, those are built and warranty generally anywhere from 10 to 15 years. Any performance you get beyond then is gravy. So we put into our models, you're going to have to, if you own it, you're going to have to be setting aside some of these savings.
Yep.
You know, you're getting year over year into a fund that's going to be there for that replacement of that inverter. And again, assuming you've done the preventive maintenance over time, maybe you can get 16, 17, 18 years, but at a certain point it's good money after bad and it's time to replace it.
Yep. Hey, let's shift gears a little bit. I didn't know that you guys were involved with the California High Speed Rail Authority.
Okay.
I just think that's so exciting. And I don't think our listeners would necessarily know this, but it's my understanding that by state statute or state mandate or law, that the operation of the high speed rail has to be completely 100% renewably powered.
That's
and
correct.
That even during the construction, I think a lot of the construction vehicles and all have to have offsets. Is that right? It's just, it's a remarkable.
High speed rail has a very strong commitment to not just their operation, you know, eventually, but also in their construction process to sustainability. Their head of sustainability, Meg Cedaroth, is a real rock star in terms of what she's done to help the agency really be a leading entity. And if you really want to go deep into, you know, high speed rail, I'd encourage you to get Meg on your podcast. She's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So now what's your role with that? Or what's Terra Verde's
role? We were hired, I think, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, back when, you know, we were in more conceptual stage, to help the agency figure out what would be the most cost-effective way of meeting that 100% renewable energy mandate. At the time, there was this question of, well, why don't we just, you know, the grid's going to be 100% renewable. Why don't we just buy power from the grid and, you know, then we'll be fine. And so we did a bunch of analyses and turns out that a distributed generation model with, you know, both solar distributed batteries and taking into account regenerative braking capabilities of the train, doing it properly, you could operate the train much more cost effectively and, equally important, much more resiliently. I mean, the word, you know, the reality is the grid is not 100% reliable, and we know this is getting worse, you know, because we, in our asset management group, we monitor outages all the time. Because we are grid tied with, and over the years, the number and length of outages is increasing. That's just the reality. The train, you can't have, you know, 500 people on a train and all of a sudden the power goes out in the middle of nowhere. That's not a good thing. So both from a cost effective standpoint and a resiliency standpoint, we've put together a model for how they can go about putting distributed generation and batteries along the right of way at land that they have control over to have the most cost efficient and resilient system. It sounds like, oh yeah, how many panels and how many batteries? Part of the modeling also involved the load, because nobody's ever operated a train this way. And so we had some really interesting, you know, our analysts had some really interesting times figuring out, based on the speed of the train, the curve of the track, the elevation of the track, the airflow over, you know, the train itself, right? The resistance from air, the regenerative braking capabilities, multiple factors. What is the exact load going to be at various points along the line? In between stations and so forth. And that then determines much more specifically how much solar do you need, how much battery do you need, in what locations, and operating in what way.
So is there any simple rule?
I'm sorry?
Any rule of thumb, like you need a couple megawatts per mile or anything like that, or track, or?
I mean, unfortunately, I'm a little too distant. I know there probably were rules of thumb that we came up with, but what I do know is that you know, our numbers were checked by, you know, other engineering groups, and we nailed it. Great.
And I think the Dutch are running all their trains on renewables now. So fascinating.
It's like car transportation. Once you figure out how electricity works with transportation, you'll never go back to anything else. It's just such a much more efficient, cost effective, and obviously from a climate standpoint, a cleaner way to go to move things.
Hey, Rick, we've had discussions on the podcast before about the changes of net energy metering in California and the introduction of net billing. Mm-hmm. And I think most people most of our listeners are aware that there has been this radical change, and it's really had a harmful effect on distributed generation in California. I think that'll ripple all over the country. But I'm excited. What I really want to ask you about is, are you feeling that the legislature is going to rise up here? And we have, there's at least a half dozen bills in the legislature, in the state Senate, AB 1999, 22619, 1374, goes on and on. Are you optimistic that our legislature can put the pressure on the PUC to reverse or to augment this ruling that's just pretty much wiping out the residential distributed solar?
Well, it's also having a pretty negative impact on commercial, which includes schools and public agencies and farms and businesses and so forth. That we haven't seen that drop off quite as quickly because project timelines for those projects are much longer, but we will see that drop off, I think, in the interim. I'm an optimist, so let me just put that out. So I'm always optimistic. Okay. It's going to be a lift, because historically, the legislature has really had a wall between what it does and what it expects of the CPUC. And so when a CPUC makes a decision, the legislature is very reluctant to overturn what they've done for all kinds of good reasons. But with the decisions, the net billing tariff decision, and particularly the net metering aggregation and virtual net metering decisions that were later this this in the fall, there's a, you know, I was in Sacramento on Wednesday talking to lots of different legislators. And there's a sense that I got for the first time in the really 16, 17 years I've been doing lobbying and advocacy, there's a sense that the CPUC went too far. They really overshot what the right policy decision should be, particularly as it impacts schools and other public agencies. They make the argument about cost shift, right? And I think there's disagreement that there's some degree of cost shift in the residential sector, although there's a lot of mythology out there about the degree that that exists and the fact that there are alternative ways of looking at distributed generation in the residential sector, where if you really allow that sector to participate in providing grid services as an alternative to the much more expensive ways that the IOUs want to use them, that that cost shift not only disappears, it goes in the other direction. But putting that aside for the moment, there's no question that schools and other public agencies do not create a cost shift. The CPUC's own look-back study, and you can look this up, Net Energy Metering Look-Back Study 2022, unequivocally states non-residential solar projects pay more than their cost of service. In other words, they are subsidizing ratepayers.
Already.
Yep. Yet those customers were thrown into the same bucket in the NBT Net Metering 3.0 decision. And when we've challenged the CPUC, the governor's office, we get crickets. Right.
Yep.
Because they don't want to face the fact that they've really hurt schools and other public agencies' ability to go solar and that their justification is just false. Their own study says, I'm going to repeat it because I yell this from the rooftops and I never get any response. Their own study says schools and other non-residential solar customers under net metering 2.0 pay more than their cost of service. Now, the reason is because they pay demand charges, which is the way, not just volumetric charges, which is the way in which you address, quote unquote, the grid needs. And yet they still got thrown into that bucket. So I'm very optimistic that SB 1374, authored by Senator Josh Becker and sponsored by the School Energy Coalition, Undaunted K-12, and there's going to be multiple school districts, farms, multifamily housing folks, you know, who are going to be joining in and endorsing it. I'm very optimistic we'll get that bill passed because that reverses what was a 10-year policy that allows a school or entity that has a multi-meter property. You have solar on the parking lot, and you also have four or five other meters. And you used to be allowed to generate power at that site and then offset your energy use at those other sites because, oh, by the way, by the laws of physics, the electricity that isn't being used at that parking lot is ending up at those other meters because that's how electricity flows.
That's right.
But CPUC changed that so that schools would have to sell their power at wholesale, any power generated at that site, and buy it back at retail. I mean, that's patently unfair. And so I am optimistic that that one will go through. The other bills to kind of change the way in which the CPUC addressed the net metering conundrum, that's going to be a heavier lift, but we're going to work on it.
Yeah. Good stuff. And Rick, just a couple, we're at our time here. I could talk to you for many, many episodes worth, but when you've put so much into all this, how do you get balance in your life? And maybe you're just getting balance now that you've stepped back a little bit from work, but.
It's a really good point, Ted. I mean, like I said, I retired 4 years ago, but my wife says, you're not retired. You know, you're doing all this stuff. I'm semi-retired. That's my word for it. And the way I do it is I walk a couple hours a day with my dog, Juno, who's sleeping on the floor now after her hour walk this morning. And when I walk, I ruck. So I put a 40-pound backpack on my back when I'm walking to kind of make it, you know, talk about balance, making sure I can, you know, carry the weight and stay in balance. And then I, you know, I try to, you know, it's sort of a personal spiritual practice of just really looking, like I say, through the lens of hope and through the lens of optimism, and having support. I have a men's group that I've been in for 50 years. Okay. And that, you know, having that group of men, you know, as my support, I have wonderful wife, I have wonderful daughters. You know, those are the things that keep me in balance.
That's great. Good stuff. Well, listen, thanks for being on the podcast. Thanks for all
thank
of your
so much for giving me a chance to talk with you about this stuff. It's great to catch up.
Let's do it again.
Okay.
Really appreciate it, Rick. Thank you.
I know.
Bye. That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.